But the forces for change in the world beyond Athens were not easily kept at bay, and by 600 BC, even the Eupatrids were starting to embrace them. Cosmopolitanism, for those with sufficient fashion sense, had long promised ready entry to an international fast set. Its members felt their truest sense of identity not with compatriots from the grubbing lower classes, but with fellow sophisticates from across the entire Greek world. "I simply adore the good things of life," a statement that raised no eyebrows whatsoever among those who believed that luxury held up a mirror to the gods. The passion for luxuries, most of which had to be shipped from overseas, inevitably boosted the fortunes of those with their fingers in the import-export trade. Capital, which had previously been tied up almost exclusively in the estates of the nobility, grew increasingly liquid. By 600 BC, a momentous innovation was being introduced to the cities of Ionia: coinage. Over the following decades, it would cross the Aegean and begin to circulate in Greece. The aristocracy, unsurprisingly, reacted with disgust and mounting alarm. They bristled at the prospect of a businessman having the same spending power as a Eupatrid, and responded with increasingly frantic insults. "Kakoi," they called the nouveau riche, the low-born, the unpleasant, the cheats. The Kakoi, however, as they could afford to do, merely shrugged their shoulders and continued to rake in the cash. After all, as a Spartan had once pointed out, a man is nothing but the sum of what he owns. Fitting slogan for a new and perplexing age. Gold is the only thing that makes for breeding now. So, with a curling of the lip, might the déclassé nobleman complain. There is no other basis of esteem. Once again, just as in Lacedaemon a century previously, a whole region of Greece was crippled by an agrarian crisis. As impoverished noblemen, threatened with the loss of their patrimony, tightened the screws on their tenants, so misery was passed down the food chain to the very poorest, from the mansions of great families to the barest, rockiest plots. Creditors, mapping the limits of mortgaged olive groves and fields, filled the countryside with ominous lines of stones. They might just as well have been marking out the graves of ruined peasants. As it worsened, the land famine drew an inevitable recourse. Just over the straits from southern Attica, temptingly, indeed irresistibly close, lay the island of Salamis. After an abortive attempt to claim it as their own, the Athenians plunged into a gloomy introspection. So desperate did the situation appear that the Athenians began to cast around for a sage. In 594 BC, Solon, universally held to be the wisest man in Athens, was given the archonship, the city's supreme magistracy. A blue-blooded descendant of an ancient Attic king, Solon had also dabbled in trade, while simultaneously letting slip to the poor his sense of outrage at their plight. It was evident to Solon that the two great crises facing Athens, agrarian and military, both sprang from the same root. Rural impoverishment was enfeebling the reserves of Attic manpower. Farmers were sinking ever deeper into serfdom. The poor, if truly desperate, might end up chained and shackled as slaves in their own fields. Solon chose to redeem them. Even those who had been sold abroad were liberated, while in Attica itself, wherever property had been mortgaged, Solon ordered a general pardoning of debts. Out in the fields, men were set to work digging up the boundary stones where they had been set in the dark earth. Most landlords, naturally enough, were outraged, but Solon, playing the selfless sage to the hilt, argued sternly that his reforms were in their interests too. After all, without the bedrock provided by a free peasantry, what hope was there of capturing Salamis, or of preserving Athens from social meltdown, or of winning for the city a rank commensurate with her size? His laws, inscribed in public on revolving wooden tablets, served to spell this out to every class of citizen. To the poor, they guaranteed freedom and legal resource against the abuses of the powerful. To the rich, they gave exclusive right to magistracies and the running of the city. Even the poorest peasant could know himself to be as free as the haughtiest Eupatrid. Admittedly, he was not as much of a citizen. He was barred from standing for office or making his voice heard in debate. Yet the rich, even though they still hugged political power to themselves, could not entirely afford to ignore him and his fellows. The poor may have been silent in the assembly, but not without a vote.